Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. This time, award-winning journalist and author Alilia Bundles talks about her latest book, Joy Goddess, Alilia Walker and the Harlem Renaissance, published by Scribner this month. Joy Goddess explores the life and times of the author's great-grandmother. Alilia Bundles was interviewed by fellow biographer and BIO member Eric K. Washington.
Alilia, hi.
Eric.
You know, I was calculating on my fingers and I'm thinking we've known each other for about 10 years on a number of levels, some overlapping projects. But I think first it was through Columbia University when you were a trustee and I became an Alilia Bundles Community Scholar through Columbia, but also through my own biography, Boss of the Grips, which you were very helpful on. And Alilia Walker appears in that. And then more recently, our launch of Where Harlem Rests, highlighting notable African-American burials at Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. So it's nice to be talking to a familiar.
Well, you know, and we really do live in this world of biography and this world of the 1920s and Black history in New York. So I love that there are so many overlapping ways and intersections and our membership in BIO.
Yes. As a matter of fact, you were the one who first told me about BIO.
Oh, great. And then you've taken it on to another level in leadership roles, which I love.
As Sister Sledge once said, we are family.
Absolutely.
So who was Alilia Walker?
So Alilia Walker is best known as the only daughter of Madam C.J. Walker, the early 20th century businesswoman, hair care entrepreneur, philanthropist, political activist, who also is my great-great-grandmother. And Alilia Walker is my great-grandmother, and I wanted to tell her story separate from or in addition to her mother's story, which is much more well-known because she's a larger-than-life American icon. But Alilia Walker had her own niche, her own special way of living, and as the what I think is the first Black celebrity heiress who had inherited her mother's homes and business and money, she became a central figure of the Harlem Renaissance with her parties, with her travels, with her friendships with the writers and musicians and actors of the era. Why is she called Joy Goddess? Because Langston Hughes, the poet, wrote about her in his memoir, The Big C. And as he told stories about her gatherings and the people that she knew, he said that Alilia Walker was the joy goddess of Harlem's 1920s because of these great parties and just because of the way she moved in the world. She wanted to create a welcoming space for people from uptown, from downtown, internationally, from the Caribbean, Central America, the South, Europe, Africa, etc. So she just was a charismatic person who created joy for other people.
And what was, for the uninitiated, the Harlem Renaissance?
So the Harlem Renaissance is an era during the early 20th century when there was a great flowering of Black culture and art with the music and the poetry and the novels and dance and theater and all of those things that were being produced. Was a bit of a response, both just people wanting to express themselves, but also responding to the racism of the Woodrow Wilson administration, to these what was called the New Negro, men who were coming back from France after World War I, Black men who had fought on behalf of America, who wanted to be treated with dignity, and who weren't going to accept going back to being in their place. And so this cultural flowering, as well as more of a political assertion, really was the Harlem Renaissance. Now, some people, as you know, because we sometimes have emailed each other in the middle of the night looking for citations, that some people say, oh, the Harlem Renaissance really starts with the return of Black soldiers from France in February 1919, the assertion of this political new Negro. Others say it's 1921 with Shuffle Along, a Broadway production that was beloved by people all over the city. And then others have been giving this date of 1925, which was the Civic Club dinner when many of the young Black writers were being celebrated.
And I like that because I think you can never have too many birthdays. Well, I shouldn't say that, up to a certain point. So, Alelia Walker grew up in the shadow of a singular legendary figure, as you said, her mother's shadow. It seems inevitable that her life was lived under a microscope. Talk about how she navigated with that or wrestled to find her own voice.
Yeah, I mean, it is very difficult, very challenging to have a parent who is larger than life, who everybody knows, who was, many people say, the first self-made American woman millionaire in business. And Madam Walker was legendary, but Alelia Walker, as her daughter, was inevitably compared to her mother, and she was not going to be that sort of original that Madam Walker was. And at the same time, she had been very involved in the early development of the business. I mean, Madam Walker had been a washerwoman named Sarah Breedlove until she was 38. So Alelia was a young adult when her mother began to be successful. So she already had her own view of the world. But with this accumulation of wealth, both women loved culture, both of them traveled. They had beautiful homes, and Alelia Walker benefited from that. But this comparison to her mother, that she would never be the same businesswoman with the same drive as her mother, made her feel the need to define herself in her own way. And I think part of what she did was to take a little bit of her mother's personality and desire to do big things. And it manifested itself in her support of the arts as a patron of the arts. Her mother had supported musicians and theater people and artists before, and Alelia sort of redefined it in her own way within the context of the Harlem Renaissance.
So now you already wrote extensively about Alelia Walker in On Her Own Ground, your biography of Madam C.J. Walker. So what compelled you to write about Alelia now or to dig deeper? Or were there still things that you felt you needed to know that weren't answered? 2001, was that On Her Own Ground?
So a couple of things led me to that. I will say that when I was in high school in 1970, I actually wrote a report about Alelia Walker and the Harlem Renaissance. So in many ways, she fascinated me at that stage in my life more than Madam Walker. I mean, we had the same name and almost the same birthday. I was just beginning to discover Black writers during that period of time. So we're, late 60s, early 70s. And she knew those people. We had some of those books at home that had been at the Dark Tower and that had been in her homes in New York. So a first edition of Langston Hughes's The Weary Blues and Countee Cullen's Ballad of a Brown Girl and Jean Toomer's Cain. So I was finding myself, racial identity at that period of time. And Alelia Walker spoke more directly to that. Madam Walker was more complicated for my 18-year-old self. She was a businesswoman. She was involved in politics. And at that point, the politics of hair was a big deal as people were wearing afros for the first time. And people identified Madam Walker with the hot comb, which she did not invent, but which people believed. And so I kept her a bit at arm's length. Then eventually I began to do research and write about Madam C.J. Walker. I wrote a young adult book that came out in 1991. And then when I was writing On Her Own Ground, The Life and Times of Madam C.J. Walker, I first thought I was going to do a double biography of mother and daughter. And about halfway through, I realized that Alelia Walker needed her own biography because she lived another 11 years after Madam Walker's death. But I tried to begin to develop the relationship between mother and daughter in On Her Own Ground to set things up for this next book, which took a lot longer than I thought to write. But I think that's a theme with members of bio.
Were there a lot of things while you were working on the Alelia Walker biography that were just new to you from the time that you were addressing Alelia Walker in her mother's biography?
Oh, absolutely. When On Her Own Ground came out in 2001, I had immersed myself in Madam Walker's correspondence, Alelia Walker's correspondence, and with their attorney, Freeman B. Ransom. So I knew the details of their lives up to 1919, up to Madam Walker's death. And I knew a little bit about Alelia Walker's life. I had interviewed some of the survivors from the Harlem Renaissance who were still living, Alberta Hunter and Jimmy Daniels and Bruce Nugent. So I had some sense of those friendships. Jerry Major was another person, but I still had a lot more research to do. And so then, over those next many, many years of writing this book, then I was able to immerse myself in Alelia Walker's letters between 1919 and her death in 1931. You know, and as you know, newspaper research, black newspapers are so essential to the books that we write. And prior to 2001, if I wanted to read the Chicago Defender, I either would have to get interlibrary loan or I would have to go to Chicago to the public library and scroll through microfilm. But for this last decade, I've had newspapers.com and ProQuest and other databases with black newspapers. And so I've been able to really expand what I knew about Alelia Walker. So I think the things that were the biggest revelations, I sort of knew the headlines, but I was able to really document how much of a patron of the arts she was. And she was much more than, as one Harlem Renaissance historian, you know, pegged her in a book in the early 1980s, saying she spent the 1920s playing bridge. So while I do know that she liked bridge and she enjoyed a good round of poker, she was so much more than that. And I was really happy to be able to give her those dimensions.
It's one of the things I liked. I'm a bridge brat.
Ah.
My father and stepmother met each other at a bridge convention, and I never learned to play. But it goes back. It was, and now it's, you know, the organization, American Bridge Association, is dying out because the median age, I think, is 85 to 90.
And I've never learned to play bridge. My great aunt was a big bridge player. The thing that I got out of that was she gave me a great recipe for candied pecans, which I make for Christmas every year. But that was her sort of her snack during her bridge games. But bridge is not an easy game. So it's not, you know, it's not for people who aren't smart. So if that was meant to be a put down, I think that it failed. Eric,
No.
I will say another thing that I learned about her. I knew that Alelia Walker had gone on a trip to Europe, Africa, and the Middle East in 1921 and 22, but I was able to dig more deeply and find much more information. And one of the gifts from the ancestors to me was her travel diary, which I had not had. And when Alelia Walker died in 1931, my grandparents moved her belongings to Indianapolis, where they lived at the time. And that's where those first edition books were. They were in the apartment. And when my grandfather in the 1960s moved from Indianapolis back to Pine Bluff, Arkansas, where he had grown up, he took some things, but he put a lot of things in storage in Indianapolis, but he wasn't paying the bill. And so I felt fortunate to have so many things, but I thought, well, some things I'll just never have. But about 7 or 8 years ago, the nephew of the founder of the storage company, who happened to be a family friend, started cleaning out the back of the warehouse. And every few months, he would send me a box. And in one of those boxes was Alelia Walker's travel diary. So
Oh,
while I had guessed and speculated that she must have spent time with Louis Mitchell and Antoinette Brooks Mitchell. Louis Mitchell, a famous jazz drummer who played in great clubs in Paris. I guessed that that had happened because I knew she knew them. Now I had the documentation in her diary saying, and on the first night, had dinner with Louis and Antoinette Mitchell.
that's great.
People have no idea our late night emails back and forth. And Eric, I love that you love a rabbit hole as much as I do.
Yeah, it's the rabbit holes that have rabbit holes, that
Right.
the Warrens, you know.
Yes, Warrens.
So, you know, for a century, books and other media have evoked Alelia Walker's name, Are there some essential insights or themes that others have not asked and sort of consistently failed to ask about Alelia Walker?
You know, I think that there's this kind of easy trope of Madam Walker made the money, Alelia Walker spent the money. She had big parties, you know, and that was kind of the only thing that some people were willing to give her. But I really think you can't just look at a person and not know what's going on internally. And so what I've tried to do is really talk about the complexity of her life. That, you know, she can't live up to her mother's image. You know, it's just impossible to be the second Madam Walker. There is a one Madam Walker. But she did participate in the business, and she also had really great marketing ideas. And so I wanted to be able to show that. But on the personal side of her life, it's complicated. Now, her relationship with her mother is complicated. You know, as their secretary, Violet Reynolds, said, they loved each other dearly and they sometimes fought fiercely. And I think that happens with a lot of mother-daughter, father-son relationships where there's tension. So that was part of it. There also were her decisions about her marriages. You know, she had really complicated marriages. But I wanted to kind of, without, you know, psychoanalyzing her, just to know that her father died when she was three. Her first stepfather was a violent person who mistreated her mother. She made some bad decisions about the men that she married, and there was a conflict between her and her mother over two men, both handsome, both doctors. One was a good guy, one was a bad boy, and you can imagine what happened, and that is all in the book. And then she had a stroke in 1924, and I think that also informed how she moved in the world. So I wanted to show reasons why she made the decisions that she made.
And a fascinating thing I found about her, perhaps by extension of Madam C.J. Walker's ethic as a consummate philanthropist, is Alelia's own talent as a convener of disparate social figures, be it at, you know, her Villa Loira mansion in Westchester, her Harlem apartment on Edgecombe Avenue, or her Harlem townhouse that became the salon that became known as the Dark Tower. So there were things that were carried over from mother to daughter, but just in a different style with her own voice.
Different style, different generations, you know, and her friends were professional women, Jerry Major, Bessie Bearden, A. Philip Randolph's wife, Lucille Green Randolph. You know, these were women who had their own professional lives, different from the previous generation where Madam Walker and her friends, yes, there was Mary McLeod Bethune, who had a college, Lucy Laney, who had an educational institution, other women who were part of the National Association of Colored Women, but they were club women, and Madam Walker was the businesswoman, but their social uplift work was different from that of Alelia Walker and her friends, where they cared about Jim Crow, they cared about the anti-lynching movement, but they, rather than have a convention and talk about raising money by passing the collection plate, they were having dances and galas where they raised money. And sometimes those kinds of things get devalued by people because they're seen as frivolous and as parties, but they were for a bigger purpose.
I want you to talk a bit about your process. You know, the book flows chronologically over 42 chapters, which is double the amount that were in On Our Own Ground. How did you organize your research and writing process? And I love the fact that they were small, but you really feel like you're making progress like very, very, very quickly. And they were very short but succinct. And was that a particular strategy to make smaller chapters?
No. I'm laughing because it was so organic. I've been working on this book, and I, you know, the honest length of time is since 2006. I was doing other things, you know, in those many years, you know, some leadership roles in other organizations and other kind of things. So it wasn't like I wasn't sitting at the computer every day, but it took a long time. And I had organized my research really carrying over from On Her Own Ground. But as I wrote this book, I was just writing what came out. I was writing the book, trying to incorporate all of those tangents and make them coherent. And then finally, I don't know, 2 years ago or so, when my editor finally did the long slog of reading my original manuscript, it was really long. And She gave me really great guidance and said, you know, you're going to have to lose a lot of this because you do want your reader to have a good experience. And, you know, the old, there are too many characters or there are too many tangents. So when I started cutting down and started revising and trying to distill and stick to the things that really advanced the story, some of those chapters that are very short were very long. And I did not plan for them to be very short. Once I had said what I wanted to say in a chapter, then it just needed to end. And I didn't want to, sometimes there, you know, you think, well, should I combine these two chapters? Well, I was trying to stick to a theme in each chapter or an episode in each chapter. So that's how that came about. So yes, I was not planning to have 42 mostly short chapters.
I rather loved
It
it.
was organic.
Yeah. Because I mean, yeah, that process of like when you got so much stuff and you, even though you know everything can't go in, trying to make that decision while you're writing and putting it down, you don't want to put something aside that you'll forget about and then you'll look for it, you know. So it's, it felt just right.
Well, so Kathy Belden and Rebecca Jett are my editors at Scribner, at Simon and Schuster. And they were really wonderful, you know, very gentle and very wise about saying, well, I think you've gone on too long here. And what is the point of this chapter? So they steered me really very well. And you know, so the power of a good editor who is who has a gentle touch, a gentle but firm touch. I can talk about the research if you'd like.
Yeah, so well, one of the things, like, I mean, the handwritten letters, such as those between Alelia and the company business manager, Freeman Ransom, were obviously a gold mine. What other archives and sources were particularly useful or perhaps serendipitous?
You know, part of Madam Walker's genius was that she hired a really wonderful executive team. So Freeman B. Ransom, who was her attorney and general manager, was very organized. And as an attorney, you know, had that kind of legal mind to keep documentation. Her secretary, Violet Reynolds, who had been hired as a teenager in 1916, was my neighbor and was still working at the Walker Company in 1970, had really made sure that those letters were saved. And so that body of correspondence, as well as business records and legal documents, we donated to the Indiana Historical Society in the early 80s. And that was really the foundation for a lot of my research, having these letters. It's really quite rare for a Black business to have that amount of documentation. And then I supplemented it with the interviews with the Harlem Renaissance survivors, with the Black newspapers. And then since I started doing this research those many, many years ago, there's so many wonderful books, including yours, and biographies of people who were part of the Harlem Renaissance that just didn't exist in the 1970s when I started doing this research. And it is, I think, this flowering of Black scholarship and our own interest and our advocacy for these stories that have allowed me to tell this story. You know, one thing about how I organized the materials in the early 80s, Alex Haley actually approached us about doing a mini series and doing, I guess, a sort of fictional biography of Madam Walker. And I'd written my master's paper at Columbia in 1975 and 76 on Madam Walker. So I'd sort of started the research. And as I was doing research for what was supposed to be the project he was going to do, he made a suggestion to me about organizing my material. And he said, make a folder for every year of your character's life, which I did. And I still have those folders. And some of those folders, you know, like 1919 is about 10 folders, but I have all of that material. And then I made a folder for every character, even if they were minor characters. So I have, you know, several milk crates full of those characters and then major organizations. So that's how my research is organized. You know, now I might try to do that electronically, but at this point, I have a lot of paper in my house.
I often ask in an interview, did you find any living descendants of your subject? But that's you. I think you remain masterfully objective throughout the book, and not uncritical of, you know, while examining a life. so indelibly linked to your own. So how does telling the story make you feel?
I am so glad to, first to have Madam Walker's story out there so people know who she is, and now to have Alelia Walker's story out there so that she's not just a footnote. She's not just the caricature of somebody's imagination and projection. And people can judge for themselves. I mean, these were not perfect people, because who is? Nobody is. They're not human if they are. And I did have this really wonderful gift from my mother when I was working on my paper at Columbia in 1975. I went back to Indianapolis for the Christmas holidays and told her what I was finding and that Madam Walker wasn't perfect. And I think at that point, I found out she'd had a divorce. That's not a big deal, but to my 23-year-old mind, it's like, what do I do about that? And she was in the hospital with lung cancer and terminal. But we were having this conversation, and I said, Mommy, what do I do about this? And she said, tell the truth, baby. It's all right to tell the truth. And as a trained journalist, and as the daughter of a woman who told me I could tell the truth, I really felt that I had permission and really an obligation to readers to do that.
I thought that was great because, Alelia Walker sometimes emerged as, in your words, inexplicably unsympathetic.
I would say it was especially tough writing about my grandmother. I never met my grandmother. She died in 1945 when my mother was a freshman at Howard. But I got to know her through the letters, and I could see, I mean, she had quite a dilemma. She was adopted. She still had contact with her biological family. She was kind of a Black Cinderella story, but it was also a Cinderella story that came with a lot of restrictions and a lot of twists and turns. And I felt so for my grandmother, but then I could see that later she had her own mind about things. She was a strong personality, but she had endured a lot of stuff, I think, unnecessarily. And so it was tough to imagine what she was going through.
So how is Alelia Walker's influence germane to today's political climate of cultural erasure?
When people look beneath the surface of the parties and the joy and the entertainment that we celebrate as part of the Harlem Renaissance, it was in response to the racism, to the restrictions, to the exclusion that we were experiencing as a community. And yet, in Harlem, really for the first time, there was this critical mass of talent and professionally trained people and educated people. And Harlem obviously was a much larger community with a wide range of economic statuses. But this was a moment when people were saying, I'm creating my own world. When I walk outside of this space, I don't know what I'm going to find. But when I come back to this space, when I come to Alelia Walker's homes, when I go to the apartment of some of my friends in Harlem, we have our world where we know we have value. And I think we're seeing that now. Today I saw a young woman who's created Juneteenth flags and memorabilia. And she said her company is doing really well because people are resisting by buying her items. Other people are creating their own cultural salons. Other people are continuing to do business. And at the same time, I have friends, and I have experienced it myself, where speeches that we would have made, or deals that people might have gotten, or contracts that people might have gotten, are being canceled because of this administration. But this is not the first time that we've been an unpopular and out of favor.
So lastly, what advice would you give to first-time biographer, and particularly someone working on a project of similar scope and complexity as yours?
Organize your material. Alex Haley's advice to me still makes sense. Keep those files, because there's no way that I would be able to find the material that I needed after literally decades of working on this story. I would say join Bio because it is such an incredible community of people. It is Pulitzer Prize winners, and it is people who are wondering if they have a story to tell. Have friendships with people like you, Eric, who are supportive. Writing is so solitary, but it's the community of kindred spirits that I think keeps pushing you on.
Yeah, hear, hear. Thank you, Alelia Bundles.
Thank you, my friend.
That was journalist and author Alelia Bundles speaking with Eric K. Washington about her latest book, Joy Goddess, Alelia Walker and the Harlem Renaissance. It was published by Scribner this month, and this interview was recorded via Zoom on June 19th of this year.